question is, you've got that bound, can you realize it? Okay, or maybe there's a better bound. Okay, and so, well, one of the examples, well, the first example is the so-called complete graphs, where you have a bunch of vertices and every two of them are joined. Well, they're more graphs, they're not very interesting as they go on. The second class, which is slightly more interesting, would be the odd cycles. Now, these are more graphs where each vertex has got two neighbors, so the balance here is two, and the diameter here is one. This is a complete graph, so three vertices every two join. This has got diameter two, this has got diameter three. And if you want to draw the nine cycle, you have one diameter four, but there's infinitely many. Well, okay, so I've got a certain number of examples. They're not the world's most exciting graphs, and so we pretty much stop there. But here's another example. Now here, the balance here is three. Each vertex has exactly three neighbors. There are 10 vertices, which is 3 squared plus 1. And the diameter is 2. You can get from any vertex, say the top vertex, to any other in at most 2 steps. And so this is a Mohr graph with diameter 2 and balance 3. And so, as what I've just seen, Mohr graphs with diameter 1 are kind of very interesting, and Mohr graphs with balance 2 will be the odd cycles. This is the first non-trivial example. Unfortunately, a fairly large share of the rest of them, but still, it's there and it's not trivial at all. Now, as I just said, in fact, there aren't that many more graphs, and I want to just consider what happens in the case where diameter is 2. The general case is more difficult, but we can talk about that case where diameter is 2. Now, the tool we want to use here is the adjacency matrix of the graph. Okay. So this is a symmetric 0-1 matrix. The rows and columns are indexed by the vertices, and the ij entry is 1 into vertex I is adjacent to vertex j. And otherwise it's 0, it's a 0-1 matrix. So it's the adjacency matrix, and to make it completely concrete, there's an example for the fire cycle, which is the Mohr graph diameter 2 and balance 2. So it's a matrix. The other thing to notice is that it's always going to be 0 in the diagonal, because no vertex is adjacent to itself. Okay. So we've got the adjacency matrix. Now, the surprising thing is if you're given a Mohr graph with diameter 2, then it's actually fairly easy to show that the adjacency matrix satisfies that quadratic equation. Okay. Now, life would be simpler if you didn't have this j on the right-hand side, but it's there. Now, this j is just the square matrix of entry equal to 1. Okay. And so if a Mohr graph exists, so if there's a graph which meets that bound, so you want a graph diameter 2 and actually bounty k, so it's got k squared plus 1 vertices if it exists. Okay, and there are two examples, the pentagon, the fire cycle, which has got bouncy 2, and the Beetson graph, which has got bouncy 3. And we're trying to see if there's any others. And the observation is we're going to get this equation, and that's a fairly simple to derive. The surprising thing is you can do something with it. You can determine all the eigenvalues, the adjacency matrix from that. And I'm going to spare you the details, but you find that the eigenvalues are the bouncy of the graph, k, and then there's two more, which are just called theta and tau. One's positive, the other's negative. And so that follows from that quadratic equation. And with a little bit more work, you can work out that if k is bigger than 2, then theta and tau must be integers. And the multiplicity of, well, either one would do, but multiplicity of tau is given by this formula. Now, think about that formula. That's a formula for multiplicity. So that's the multiplicity of an eigenvalue. It better be an integer. But now, if you look at it, 2 theta plus 1 and theta plus 1 are going to be co-prime. Work it out. And 2 theta plus 1 and theta squared plus 1 are co-prime, and these two things are co-prime. So that's not a great integer very often. So you can amuse yourself by playing with it. And in fact, the only time it's an integer is when k is 2, 3, 7, or 57. So that tells you immediately there's at most four Mohr graphs of diameter 2. Okay. And tells you more, it tells you the possible balances. Now, this work was done by Hoffman and Singleton in 1960, or this group, they were published in 1960, and they found the Beetson graph there, of course, and they saw this potential graph with bounty 7 on 7 squared plus 150 vertices, and so they constructed a graph, which is now called the Hoffman-Singleton graph, which is a very interesting graph, and they couldn't do anything with the graph of bounty 57, which would have 3,250 vertices. And, well, essentially 50 years later, and nobody has ever done anything with it since. We have no idea whether that graph exists or not.
Would you write down how many possible graphs there have been with that many
I was thinking last night, I was thinking about this, the question about how many particles there are in the universe. I think the number of graphs on 30 vertices is already bigger than the particles in the universe, and this is a graph on 3,250, so it's beyond any damage that we're going to do with any computer, quantum or otherwise, I think, at this point. So it's wide open. The only thing we know is it can't be vertex transitive, kind of strange, so they can't have a group of automorphisms with the property that any one vertex can be mapped to any other. The graphs on balancing the pentagon on the Petersen graph and the thing on balancing 7 have each got a large group of automorphisms, which can, and has a property you can map any one vertex to any other using devices of automorphism. It's known that if that graph balancing 57 exists, it can't be vertex transitive, which is not very useful because the life's going to be more difficult. Okay, so this, as I said, is an example of a problem in algebraic graph theory. It's not unusual and you start with a bound, so you're looking at trying to solve an extremal problem. I mean, you can think of these more graphs as networks, which in some sense are efficient. You want as much communication as possible with fewer edges as possible. And so you've got an extremal problem, and you discover that when the bound's tight, you get algebraic information about the graph, and you can use that to get information about the existence and non-existence. And so this was the question I was just referring to. We still don't know. And so that's pure graph theory. So the next question I want to talk about is the topic of so-called mutually unbiased bases. And I want to lead into this by first considering slightly more general class of problems, or it looks different. We're dealing with a set of lines in complex space, with d dimensions. Now, okay, you've got a line, how do you specify a line? Well, there's more than a way of doing it, but the way I'm going to do it is just by giving you a unit vector which spans the line. Sometimes it's more efficient to give you the projection on the line, but because you can deal with unit vectors today. So you've got a bunch of unit vectors. Now, I've got to be a little careful here, we're working out with complex numbers, so if z is a unit vector, then so is I times z, and so you've got a lot more. If you used to think about the reals, you've got a unit vector x spanning a line, then minus x spans line, that's it. But here you've got lots of vectors that could span a line. So there's a bit hard, you know, you can specify a line by infinitely many different unit vectors, whereas over the reals you're going to do it by two. Anyway, we define the angle between the ith and jth line. We say it's determined by the absolute value of the inner product of the unit vectors. Now, we're taking the absolute value to get rid of this phase factor, this possible complex root of unity. Okay, so we don't care about that. So if we replace z by minus z, that gets washed away by the absolute value there. And so you've got a set of unit vector spanning lines, and then you've got a set of these absolute values of inner products. And I'm saying that determines the angle, and in a little while I'm going to forget that and just call it the angle, which it's not, of course. But so the problem we're concerned with is to find large sets of lines with specified angles. Now, this is a natural geometric problem and has analogs in coding theory, and I'm only considering two very special cases today. The first case is where you say, let's have one angle. Now, if you have n lines in complex dimensions, in d-dimensional complex space, so that any two distinct lines have the same angle, then it's possible to show the number of lines is at most the square of the dimension. This is a linear algebra argument, which again I'm not going to bother you with. And so you've got this bound. So again, we've got a bound. The question is, what about the trace with the bound as type? Can you get d-squared lines? If you have such things, physicists call them like a sick problem, which sounds like a disease, but and I'm going to call them a set of equiangular lines. Okay, so that's the standard mathematical terminology. Now, there's no real reason for giving the mathematical notation priority here. There has been a lot of work on this problem in the real case. Because in the real case, these questions turn out to be highly combinatorial. But there was no particular reason for looking at the complex case, and so until the physicists came along and started looking for these things, very little was done with complex space. So the question is whether you can find such sets of equiangular lines. Again, there's the precise question. The experimental evidence is that we can do it for all values of d. Some physicists have constructed examples which are sets of lines which are equiangular to machine precision, up to around d equals 40. Okay. Now, what you do with that information, that fishing is not quite clear, but it's got some conviction behind it. And there are also a number of constructions in small values of dimension, excuse me. And you face this problem. In the real case, the d squared gets replaced by d plus 1 choose 2. It's only known to be realized finitely often. The largest example is thinking of the least lattice. So it seems very unlikely that there's infinitely many examples where the bound is tight in the real case. Complex case seems to be quite different, which was surprising. And so this is an example of problem involving sets of lines, and all I want to mention here, well, it's interesting both mathematically and physically, but it's not the main one I want to talk about. The one I want to talk about is so-called mutually unbiased bases, which aren't obviously lines at all, but we'll see that there's a connection in a moment. So we're working still in d-dimensional complex space. And we're going to consider sets of orthonormal bases. Okay, so d-dimensional complex space, there's an inner product there. If this was linear algebra class, I could make this down, compute an orthonormal basis using Gram-Schmidt. There's no problem. Okay, now the situation is that we're given two orthonormal bases. And we're interested in the angles between pairs of vectors from different bases. Now, because the angle between two vectors in the same base is zero, they're orthonormal. Okay, so it's 90 degrees if you wanted, but so the inner product is probably zero. So that's a given. But we say the two bases are mutually unbiased if the angle between two unit vectors of different bases is always the same. Now, in fact, in that case, it's actually determined by the dimensions, like 1 over square root of d or 1 over square root of d plus 1. I forget, we didn't work it out in advance, so I'm not going to say any more on that. That's a set of mutually unbiased bases. Now, you can also view this as a set of lines. If you've got a set of m pairwise mutually unbiased bases in d dimensions, then you've got m d lines in m classes. Two lines in the same class are orthogonal, two lines in different classes at the same angle. Okay, so again, it's a line problem of the same type as the one we were looking at before. Okay. Now, whether the analogy is good or not is not clear to me. I mean, there is literature on problems about sets of lines with strict angles, and there's a theory even in a complex space, but so we have these two cases. Now, again, for sets of equiangular lines, we have upper bound of d squared. In this case, a similar sort of argument gives you an upper bound that tells you have at most d plus 1 mutually unbiased bases in d dimensions. You're always free to choose the first one to be the standard basis. You can always change basis and make the first one a standard basis, so that's one of them, and then you've got to find d more. And the basic problem is whether you can always find a set of d plus 1 mutually unbiased bases in d-dimensional complex space. The answer is that if d is a prime power, we can always find a set of d plus 1 as the index in the prime power gets larger, we can find more than one. And the real difficulty is what happens when d is not a prime power. But I'll come back to that. What I want to do is to describe a construction which will give me a set of d plus 1 mutually unbiased bases in d dimensions when d is a prime power. And what follows is joint work with my former graduate student, Aidan Roy. So I'm going to construct a graph. This is going to be a moderately long, complex construction. And I'm going to start with something that's equally strange. I'm going to start with the affine plane over a field by a field. Now, if you can think the integers mod p, that will work perfectly well for everything we're doing. It'll still give us something interesting, but of course there are many others. Now, if you've got a field, finally, but you can construct an affine plane, basically it's just a two-dimensional vector space over the field. Okay, so if you take a two-dimensional vector space over a field, the points of that are the points of the outline plane, and the lines, whether they follow the origin or not, are the lines of the outline plane. So mathematically, you're taking the points, and then the cosets of the one-dimensional subspaces to be the lines. Okay, so that's an outline plane. But just think, an outline plane is given by, you've got a bunch of points, x, comma, y, you've got a bunch of lines. Okay. Now, the lines could be represented by ordered pairs, A comma B. We're doing the obvious thing here for the point, so that's just a vector length 2, if you like, x and y both in F. And lines, well, so long as they're not parallel to the y-axis, we can take them to form A comma B. Now, I'm going to forget about the lines parallel to the y-axis, so I'm not using the complete affine plane. I'm taking the affine plane for a particular parallel class, thrown away, I suppose. So the only lines I need are the ones with finite slope, not parallel to the y-axis. And this is just your high school. point x, y is in the line AB if y equals ax plus b. So if I give you a point, x comma y, and a line a comma b, you can sit down and do a calculation and decide whether that point is on that line or not. Just by doing straightforward. And again, if you don't like finite fields, you can pretend the fields are real, and still it makes sense. Okay, so that's the affine plane. Now I want to construct a graph from that. Two steps. I've got to give you the points, or the vertices of my graph. Well, there's two, so I'm going to have 2 times q squared vertices. I'm going to take each of the points and each of the lines. Okay, so I've got 2 sorts of vertices, vertices corresponding to points of the plane and vertices corresponding to the line. So if q is 5, I'm going to have 50 vertices. Okay. And, okay, I've got to tell you, to complete the construction, I've got to tell you where the vertices are adjacent. Well, the vertex y, xy is adjacent with the line AB if the point xy is on the line AB. So that's as simple as can be. So that's a rule, that's a procedure. I've told you what the vertices are. I've told you how to decide whether the two vertices are adjacent. So that's determining a graph. Now, this is a fairly special graph, of course.
Yes?
Yes?
I was just going to ask, I think, what you were about to say. Sorry, go on.
It may not be useful to ask. So this is a fairly special graph, because, in fact, you can recover the affine plane from the graph. So there's not just some, it's a tight construction. And I've listed some of the properties here. It's bipartite. We can split the vertices in 2 classes, the point vertices and line vertices, and 2 vertices in the same class are not adjacent. 2 vertices are adjacent, there must be one must be a point vertex, the other must be a line vertex. Okay, so take a turn at that bipartite. It's regular, each vertex has exactly q neighbors. Now, you to verify that, you need to sit down there and fiddle with your pencil piece of paper, but it's fairly straightforward. So each line is on q points, and each point is on q lines. Now, if you know anything about affine planes, that's not news. Okay, so we've got so each vertex has got the same number of neighbors on the other side. And the other point is it has diameter 4. 2 points of the same x-coordinate turn out to be distance 4, and 2 lines in the same parallel class at distance 4. So it's got diameter 4. Now, I can continue. There are other special properties. It's actually an example of what's called a distance regular graph. And that plays a role in what I'm about to say, but you won't see it. The other thing, which isn't too surprising, since an affine plane is a highly symmetric structure, and so this graph should have lots of symmetries, lots of polymorphisms. And I've identified 2 classes there. I mean, if you're dealing with a two-dimensional vector space consisting of pairs x, y, then you can add a fixed vector a comma b to everything, and that just shuffles the points around. And it just shuffles the lines around. So it's a symmetry of the structure. And so here you get a corresponding group of, actually a group of symmetries that take a point x, y, and map to x plus u, y plus b. So you're adding a fixed vector to each point, if you like. And it does something to the lines, a bit more complicated than you would expect, but it maps lines to lines, twists around a bit. And so if you think about it for a while, you can see if I take any 2 points, I can map one to the other by using one of these T things. So there's a single orbit of points, but it turns out there are Q orbits on lines. Okay? And the S, well, they just do the same thing to the other side. It maps the line AB to A plus Y, B plus Z, and so it acts like translations on the lines. And so the nice thing about this graph I've constructed is the points and line vertices are in some sense equivalent. Now, the affine plane doesn't have that property because an affine plane's got more lines than points. Projective planes and points and lines are in duality. The affine planes don't. I'd make things nicer by throwing away one set of lines, and now I do have a kind of duality between points and lines. And so I have those 2 groups of automorphisms. Now, it turns out they're nice groups of symmetries. They're there. They're revealing any Jonathan's commute, but they're not what I need. I have to cook things up a bit. Actually, this construction is due to Dan Hughes back in the, I think, late 1950s. So the groups as it goes. So now I've got the T's and the S's, which you probably forgot what they do, and I certainly couldn't tell you. But given that I can find an element, a mapping HXY, by simply apply it, this S mapping and then this T mapping. So it's a composition 2 mapping, so it's a symmetry of my graph. And I then that gives me a set of mappings this form, and if you sit there and do the dirty work, and it's not takes a little bit of time, you'll verify that this is an abelian group of order Q squared again, but it acts transitively on the points. Given any 2 points, I can find something in H which maps the first point to the second, And it acts transitively on the lines, meaning two lines, there's an H element, which maps that first line to set. It doesn't swap points in line, so there are two orbits. But that's perfectly reasonable. The point vertices are different from line vertices, so this is in some sense as much symmetry as you might hope for, in fact there's more. And the important thing here is that you've got this abelian group, and you know, so I have a large abelian group of symmetries. And well, a little more another technical detail. In fact, you can't just construct the, it turns out I can reconstruct the graph between the group and this particular set of mappings here, which again won't be much, but this is a subset of H. It's a subset of size Q. And it turns out that the group and together with a subset determine the graph. From that I can reconstruct the graph. I won't go into details, but it's something like a construction of Cayley graph, well, not quite. But we can reconstruct the graph, entire graph, from the group H and this subset H0. Now, but anyway, what are those graphs for? We really want mutually unbiased basis, so let's get back to that. I got an abelian group. Now, an abelian group has characters, homomorphisms into the non-zero complex numbers. Okay, and in fact, a group of order Q squared will have Q squared characters. So these are functions on the vertices that map, or functions on the elements of the group that match each element of the group to a complex number, and they're a Q squared order. So they're functions on the vertices. And well, I want Q squared things, but I don't want the, I want them in Q complex dimensions, not Q squared. Well, I take the restriction of those functions to set H0. Now, H0 is a set of size Q. Now, the characters in the abelian group, they're straightforward objects. You look them up in any textbook and representation theory. So you've got the Q squared characters, and they're functions on the elements of the group. You just look at their values on H0, forget everything else. So now I've got Q squared vectors in Q dimensions. And those Q squared vectors, together with the standard basis, give you a set of Q plus 1 mutually unbiased bases. So it's something of a miracle, but it works. So I built the group, and I then construct these characters, which you can more or less identify with eigenvectors of the graph, or the decimated graph if you want to, and you get this set of mutually unbiased places. And you can do this for any field, so you get the prime field, a field of images mod P, or any field of prime power order. In fact, you can do more. It turns out you can replace field by community semi-field. Now, of course, the first thing you say, what in the hell is a community semi-field? Well, you take the axiom for a field and delete the line that says multiplication is associative. You leave in all the others, so it's still commutative. So you take the axiom for the field and throw away the associative axiom. Now, well, what are examples? Well, the best examples I can give you are fields. And you have to work fairly hard, but the finite geometers are done for us. And so you have examples of semi-fields which aren't fields and still commutative. And so this means that, you can't do it on, if the order is a prime, then any semi-field is a field. And if the order is a prime squared, any semi-field is a field. Once you get to the cube, there are constructions for semi-fields which are commutative but not fields. Mm-hmm. And some of the early work in this goes back to Don Knuth, who's better known for other things. there's some important papers on this subject by Don Knuth. Yes? No, they have to be on prime powers. Basically, the axioms force every semi-field contains a copy of the integer mod P and is a vector space over that. And so that forces it to be a prime power, unfortunately. Okay. The other comment was, well, there's an equivalent construction to this was found by, earlier unfortunately, by Quarterback, Cameron, Cantor, and Seidel. Theirs is expressed in different language, and it's somewhat harder to actually explicitly get the mutually unbiased bases out of their construction. The other thing is that the interesting thing about this construction is that the graphs I'm referring to, well, they can be constructed from these commutative semifields, but there are lots of other graphs of the same type, which don't give you sets of mutually unbiased bases, but still there's a more general context in which these things fit. And so it's not clear whether this is something which we're still thinking about, but you can construct graphs of the same form that don't necessarily have these abelian groups of symmetries. So that's a loose end which we'd like to follow. And so the other point is that all known constructions of each unbiased basis, and there's a bunch of them which are special cases of this construction. So nobody has a construction of each unbiased basis which can't be described or can't be obtained from a community standard. So that was the first of the problems that I've been working on with, as I said, with Aidan and Roy. I guess we also learnt a lot of this stuff from Martin Rertler. I want to go on to a second problem, which has got no connections, which are biased bases. But
yes, so could you give some intuition as to why those particular, so first of all, H, you know, the subset that you chose, is that a subgroup?
And, H is a group, but H0 is not.
H0 is not. I see. And so, you know, could you give us some intuition as to why the character is restricted to this, this set?
Well,
actually, gives rise to.
It's in, buried in the comment I made. The best thing I say is that the. It follows from two things. It follows that you have this large abelian group acting, and so you can do that. And the other thing is the graph you're constructing, it turns out, has very few eigenvalues. In fact, it has five different eigenvalues, including the valency. Okay, and because it's bipartite, they come in pairs, so there are essentially two eigenvalues. And so it's that condition. So that restriction on the eigenvalues, in a certain sense, correspond to angles. So I can go find other interesting just regular graphs with large with abelian groups acting on them and construct sets of lines in complex space. Now I'll get more angles, and I may not get any unbiased bases, but I'll get sets of lines with restricted angles. So what's happening is this graph has two eigenvalues. So I've read a little bit about that again before, but that's somewhat driving it. The other thing is that these graphs are in some sense seem to me dual to Minshew unbiased spaces, but whatever that means, I'm not going to pretend to explain that now. So another problem that we're looking at, I've worked on this with Mike Newman for some time. Well, it's called a game. I think anybody bothers to patent it and try and sell it, but it's a game. So you play a game with the usual Alice and Bob, and you separately offer Alice and Bob plus or minus one vectors of length to the power of 2. Okay, so 2, 4, 8, 16. Okay. But M is fixed, so let's fix it to be 4, think of it as being 16 at the moment. And then the problem for Alice and Bob is without any further communication, they must generate vectors of length M. So if the plus minus one vector of length 16, Alice and Bob have to generate vectors of length 4, satisfying two conditions. That if the vectors I gave Alice and Bob are equal, then the strings they return to me are equal. And if the vectors are orthogonal, then what's returned to them must be different. And if they're not equal, they're not orthogonal, then Alice and Bob can go and pick up coffee, doesn't matter what. So that's the problem. As I said, I don't think it's going to sell it again, but there it is. I'll get to the reason eventually. So there's a solution to this problem. It's kind of a communication problem. It seems to me, I'm not an expert in this sort of communication in any sense, but always reduces it to colouring. So first step is to construct a graph with the plus or minus one vectors, say, of length 16 as the vertices. So there's 2 to 16 vertices. And 2 vertices are going to be deemed to be adjacent if the vectors are orthogonal. Okay, so there's a graph. Okay, and that's just a change of language. Okay. Now, colouring. Alice and Bob are going to construct a proper colouring of this big graph. So in other words, they're with 2, still stick to 16. So we've got this graph on 2 to 16 vertices. They're going to assign an integer between 1 to 16 to each vertex in such a way that if 2 vertices are adjacent, they get different integers. But you're colouring. You're colouring the vertices, so the adjacent vertices get different colours. And in the case I'm thinking about, I've got to use 16 colours. Okay, so, well, if they can do that, then they're done. Because how they solve the problem, I give them a string of length 16, they go back, look up the colour that they assigned to the graph, to that vertex in the graph, and return it. Now, if I give them the same vertex, they're going to give me the same hash function back. I give them diff, if I give them orthogonal vertices, they're adjacent in the graph, they're guaranteed to give me different colors. Okay? So they can solve their problem by constructing a coloring of the vertices of this graph on 2 to the 16th vertices using 16 colors. And of course, they can't find a coloring, and they're going to have to do something else. So that's the classical solution to this problem or this game. Now, from the why I'm mentioning it here, well, first, as I said, these people here, Truman, Cleve, and Tapp, describe an algorithm which will solve the problem on omega 2 to the n for any m, provided that Alice and Bob share 2 to the n entangled pairs of qubits. So if they have these, so they share these 2 to the n pairs, then I give them into string, they use up their pairs, they give me an answer. And the other thing was that Brassard, Cleve, and Whitson showed that if there's no 2 to the n coloring of the graph, so if there's no 16 color of omega 16, then no classical algorithm will work unless Alice and Bob cheat and somehow communicate. So this will be an example of something you can do using quantum information theory you can't do classically, provided that, there's values of n for which this graph does not have a 2 to the n color. Okay, now I've got a graph on 2 to the 16 vertices. You're not going to stuff that on your computer or let Mangle run to look at the Fermi number, I think. So what can you do? The other comment I want to make here is, in a certain sense, because you can solve this problem using, null pairs, that you could say that the quantum chromatic number of omega 2 to the n is 2 to the n. The point is, by having the null pairs, effectively Alice and Bob are acting as though they have a coloring. And so there's a sense, and you can view this in a sense as a quantum coloring, and Mike Newman's been looking at this idea recently, but we haven't anything to say about it yet. Okay, as I said, if we can convince ourselves that you can't color omega 16 to 16 colors, and we know we can do something using Bell pairs you can't do classically, the first thing is you can't get away with fewer than 16 colors. Because you can find Hadamard matrices, let's say order 16 by 16. And the 16 columns that Hadamard matrix are orthogonal vectors. They're always orthogonal. And so in the graph, omega 16, they give you a set of 16 vertices, any two of which are adjacent. Now, if you're going to color the vertices of that graph, the 16 vertices that click need 16 different colors. And now, Hadamard matrices may not exist in all orders, but they certainly exist for all powers of 2. Okay. So, therefore, 2 to the n, this is why 2 to the n is chosen. We can't do it in fewer in general. So, yeah. So that's good news. The other thing, well, what about small cases? Well, 1 and 2 are trivial. 3, that's 2 to the 8 vertices already, but Gordon Royal ran his computer programs and found an 8 column. That's been done by other people since, so we know we can get an 8 coloring. So why were these physicists even thinking about the problem? Well, there's an important paper by Frankel and Rödl, which showed that if n is large enough, there isn't a proper 2 to the n coloring. Now, I think if you sat down and worked for 3 months, you could actually extract an explicit bound from this paper. I've never had the nerve to try, and I've never even had the nerve to try and induce a graduate student to do it. I think there's enough information there for you to actually extract the concrete bound. So it's not a completely abstract statement, but it's not entirely satisfactory from the point of view. If you want to say I can do something when using Bell pairs I can't do classically, and they say how many pairs do you need, you say I don't know, but it's in that paper. So you like to do better. And so in fact, well, because it did, Galliard, Tapp and Wolf proved that you couldn't find a 16 colouring of omega 16, and it was largely a clever computer calculation. And then Mike Newman and I worked this problem for quite a while, and we proved that if n is greater than 4, there's no 2 to the n colouring of omega 2 to the m. And so you start at 16, so you don't need to go through Franklin Rödl's paper, which is deep and complicated and interesting, but you don't need to go through it. To find n, n equals 4 will do. This is quite interesting because, in fact, what we did is, in some sense, we wrote out it, well, we gave another proof of this result, and then Mike found a clever recursion to show that if you couldn't do it for 16, you couldn't do it for 32 or 64 and so on. And so the net result is that we have a tight bound. And again, the other thing which is interesting from the point of view of this talk is that this graph omega 2 to the n is, again, got lots of special properties and fits into class that we mentioned briefly in the talk. So it depended on properties of the graph to affect the office in a big way. And, well, the physicists know about this, but I thought it's not the only colouring problem that turns up in quantum physics. I'll sort of briefly mention another one, which I sort of backed into many years ago. So another orthogonality graph. This time it's going to take my vertices are just the points of the unit sphere in three dimensions. Okay, so it's an infinite graph, but that's all right. Now, where's Bruce Richter? So we have an infinite graph, and two vertices, two unit vectors are adjacent to a orthogonal. Okay. And the question is whether an orthogonal colour vertices of x using three colours. Now, the way I got into this was that when I first arrived in Waterloo, Joseph Sachs was a bit compliant to us visiting, and he'd gone to a conference, and Peter Frankl asked this question. Now, it should have known better, because the answer was already known, as we'll see in a minute. There's a famous theorem in quantum mechanics, Judy Gleason, which says if you have a non-negative real function on the vertices of the unit sphere of my graph, in other words, the points of the unit sphere, that sums to one on each orthogonal basis, then f is continuous. Now, he still says more than this, but this is a part of my thing. Now, okay, explain this. The graph there is, so an orthogonal basis is just a triple pairwise orthogonal vectors. And so you've got a non-negative function on the points, and if you pick, give me an orthogonal basis, the sum of the values of my function on those three vectors must be 1. And Hippisop says that if there is such a thing, it's a continuous function. Now, suppose you could find a three colouring. Okay, let's colour it red, white, and blue. There's no need to be original. So you colour the points red, white, and blue so that two orthogonal points or vectors have the same colour. Okay, and then let's say, we'll assign the value 1 to any red vertex and 0 to the other two. Okay, now each orthogonal basis has got three different colours attached to it, and therefore it has exactly one vertex of weight 1 and two others of weight 0. And so this is a non-negative function, sums to 1 each orthogonal basis, but it's not continuous. It only takes two values, 0 and 1. So therefore, the quality of Gleason's theorem, you get that you can't colour extra three colours. Most physicists know about this, but I don't think too many graph theorists are aware of it. It's an interesting result. The other comment, well, as I said, Frankl shouldn't have been asking this question because the answer was already known. I think it was the late 50s that Gleason did this. And what we did do something, of course, a little bit of stir, we did manage to show that if you look at the rational vertices, that is the colour. It's a bit of a surprise. Okay, so that was the second problem. For the third problem, and the third physicist that we've blocked in my office,
what are the rational vertices?
The vertices with rational coordinates.
So in each component?
Each component is rational. The third problem is related to graph isomorphism. Now, graph isomorphism is an interesting problem for a number of reasons. I should explain it to Carmina. So I'll be lazy to find isomorphism using adjacency matrices. So I've got two graphs with adjacency matrices A1 and A2. The graphs are isomorphic if the adjacency matrices are permutation equivalent. Okay. And since the permutation matrix is orthogonal, this implies that A1 and A2 are similar, and then say at the same spectrum. So equivalent in the same case of polynomial. Now, I was about to say before, the problem with graph isomorphism is known to be in the class NP. But it's not known to be NP complete. In fact, it's one of the few problems where some people are prepared to conjecture that if NP is not equal to P, then this is one of the problems in the middle. Okay. The other thing is that there's an argument, based on a whole lot of evidence, that the problems that a quantum computer might be able to solve faster than a classical computer are precisely the problems that are in NP, but not between P and non-NP complete. So this is a potential problem from that point of view. It could be solved faster on a quantum computer than on a classical computer. Now, whether you believe that or not, some people do, and have been driven a bit by the idea. Now, the point is, once you realize that isomorphic graphs will have the same case of polynomial, that naturally suggests using the case of polynomial as an invariant. You can fit the case of polynomial, you get different results, the graphs are different, not isomorphic. And you can compute the case of polynomial in polynomial time. Although not with the algorithm you learned in your linear algebra course.
Are you guaranteed that you'll get different characters for different graphs?
just wait about 2 seconds.
Okay.
sorry, what happened there? Okay, we went too far. So it's a tempting idea, and so that basically the first time somebody meets Tracy upon the graph, they think about this, and in about 20 minutes, they come up with this pair of examples. So there are two graphs there, each on 5 vertices, and they have the same Tracy upon the graph. Okay. Now, and we'll meet many more examples in the course of the rest of the lecture, but so there's lots of examples of graphs which can't be recognized by the Tracy polynomial. Now, okay, so you could just give up, but some people never give up, and so you start thinking, well, what can I do? There's been lots of suggestions about trying to weight the burdens using a weighted adjacency matrix. Instead of using 0 and 1, you put alphas and betas, things like this. And the long and the short is they all fail on strongly regular graphs. And I won't actually define strongly regular graphs, but I'll give you a big class of examples and then implicitly define them. So I'm going to construct a family of graphs where this obvious approach fails comprehensively. So I'll start with the Lattice square. Now, a Lattice square is just an n by n matrix. You take with entries, say, 1 through n, with the property that each number 1 through n occurs exactly once in each row and once in each column. Okay, so the multiplication table of any finite group is a Lattice square. Okay, so in that case, it's lots of them. Well, I want to construct a graph from a Lattice square. I'm constructing graphs from all sorts of things, so now we'll get a Lattice square. Okay. Now, I've got an n by n Lattice square, so there are n squared positions. And I'll think of those positions as being my vertices. So I've got n squared vertices. And two positions will be adjacent if they're in the same row, or the same column, or they have the same entry. Okay. And so, there are two Lattice squares corresponding to the multiplication tables for the two groups of order 4. I've tried to use colours rather than numbers, just because I could. If you did follow the construction I did, you get a graph I set on n squared vertices, and you can check the following. Each vertex has 3n minus 3 neighbors. I mean, there are n minus 1 things in each row, and each column n minus 1 things the same entry. Two adjacent vertices have exactly n common neighbors, and two vertices which are different but not adjacent have exactly 6 common neighbors. Now, okay, I was referring to strongly regular graph before. What's a strongly regular graph? Well, just forget about the n squared, anything involving an n, and just look at the v, the k, the a, and the c. So the graph one, v vertices, every vertex has got exactly k neighbors. Two adjacent vertices have exactly a common neighbors, and two distinct non-adjacent vertices have exactly c common neighbors. And that would be a strongly regular graph. Now, so each Lattice square gives you a strongly regular graph. In fact, you've seen another one earlier, because the pizza graph is strongly regular. In that case, v was 10, k was 3, a was 0. You had two adjacent vertices, there was no common neighbor, there was no triangle, and c was 1. And so, in fact, a more graph of diameter 2 was guaranteed to be a strongly regular graph. Okay. But so the issue is, as I said, so this is a strongly regular graph, and they cause various problems for obvious attempts at graphic isomorphism using spectrum. And in particular, every Lattice square gives you a strongly regular graph. Again, this is going to be relevant to things coming up, but if I have a Lattice square graph, in place of the equation I had for the quadratic equation I had for the Mohr graph, I get something slightly more complicated. But if you put in a equals 0, c equals 1, and k equals 3, you'll recover the equation for the Mohr graph. Okay. So again, you have the same quadratic equation, so I can work out the eigenvalues and multiplicities in the same way that I didn't tell you about before. I might have heard that now. But the thing I want to point out to you, because I'll need it shortly, is it follows from this, among other things, that a squared, for example, is a linear combination of a, I, and j. And if you think about it a bit longer, you'll see that a cubed is a linear combination of a, I, and j. And so if I have a strongly regular graph coming, say, from Lattice square, then any power of the adjacency matrix can be written as a linear combination of the adjacency matrix, the identity matrix, and the orthogonal matrix. And that's going to matter. The other thing is that if you take inequivalent Lattice squares, now of the same order, then the graphs are co-spectral but not isomorphic. And there are lots of Lattice squares. There are more Lattice squares of order n than our graphs on n vertices. I mean, there are vast numbers of Lattice squares. Okay, now what I mean by inequivalent, I've got Instead of being nice and pictorial and thinking about Latin square as a nice matrix of colours, I'm going to do spedanic and think of it as a bunch of triples. So I'm going to imagine I've got my Latin square n by n with entries 1 through n. And for some reason I can't use matrices today, so I'm just going to write down n squared triples. I'm going to write down I, j, and then the ij entry of the matrix. It gives me a triple. I have n squared triples. And those triples determine the Latin square. Now, there are things I can do to those triples which don't really change things. I could say, swap the first and second coordinates. That would correspond to the transpose of the matrix. Okay. I can also swap the second and third coordinates, and you can work out what that means in terms of Latin square, but it's perfectly null operation. I'll swap the first and the third, or rotate them, all these things I can do. Or I can commute numbers 1 through n. And so if I can get from one Latin square number by those operations, I'll say they're equivalent. And so it turns out that Latin squares are equivalent if and if the graphs are isomorphic. So it's a natural enough condition. And so the point then stands is there are vast numbers of graphs, of Latin square graphs, which have the same strongly regular, have the same, satisfy the same quadratic equation, have the same eigenvalues, they're cospectral, but they're not isomorphic. So because of that, the obvious approach for taking weight adjustment doesn't work. Now, some time ago, physicist Terry Rudolph had an idea, which I'm going to describe now briefly. So the problem was we're being too optimistic. We shouldn't be trying for a matrix of the same size as the graph. That doesn't work. So he had the idea of trying for something bigger. So he introduced a construction which we now call the case symmetric power of graph. So another graph construction. So I'm starting now from some fixed graph, and some little graph on 10 vertices, or another little graph on 5 vertices, doesn't matter. And I've got a fixed integer k, and so I think k equals 2, that's what I'm going to be fussing about most. The vertices of my new graph are going to be the k subsets of the vertices of the original graph. So my original graph's got 10 vertices, there are 10 choose k vertices in the new graph. Okay. And when are two k subsets adjacent? They're adjacent if their symmetric difference is an edge in the original graph. So I've got two sets. So let's be thinking, I've got a graph on 16 vertices, I'm trying to construct the fifth symmetric power. And I'm taking five subsets to size 5. Now look at their symmetric difference. Now sometimes the symmetric difference will have 10 vertices to be size 10. So to get an edge, the symmetric difference must have size 2. So my two 5 sets must have 4 things in common, and then two differ on 2 things. And the 2 things which they differ must be an edge. That's the condition for adjacency. So the condition is their symmetric difference is an edge. But it might help to think of it as a symmetric difference must have size 2, and most two vertices must be adjacent. I don't know, it might make it clearer, but it's the same thing. So the first thing is that this is the Diffuse Russian, a bloody big graph, even when k equals 2. Okay. Here's a concrete example. There's the 5 cycle, carefully labelled. And there's the symmetric square of the 5 cycle, also carefully labelled. And it took me about 3 tries to get that correct, at least I think it's correct. I'm looking at the symmetric square of the 5 cycle, so I have 10 choose 2 vertices. And so the 5 vertices in the middle there correspond to the edges. There are 5 edges in the 5 cycle. And so the 5 vertices in the middle, and the 5 vertices on the outside correspond to the pairs of vertices of the 5 cycle that aren't adjacent, and there are 5 rows. And so you get this graph, and so, well, it doesn't help you much. But one thing to see is it's not regular. This vertex here has got only 2 neighbours, and these vertices here have got 4 neighbours. Mm-hmm. It turns out the number of neighbours of a pair depends on the number of edges leaving that pair, and so it depends on whether they're adjacent or not. And so this is the first surprise, this construction, even if you give it a regular graph, doesn't give you a regular graph output. So it messes things up there. There is some sort of motivation for this. The idea is, I think this is the way Rudolph was thinking of it, is you could imagine a random walk on a graph. Now, instead of having just one lamp walking around on my graph, I'm going to have k of them. And the rules are that you put the k ants down different vertices, and then at each time interval you choose one of the ants at random until it moves to an adjacent vertex and to an unoccupied vertex. Okay, so this gives you a k particle random walk. Okay, and it turns out that the random walks on the k symmetric power So that the ordinary random walks with one particle on a case of electric power correspond to the k ants on the original graph. Now the reason the walks are relevant is because the number of closed walks in a graph, whatever that is determines the spectrum, and it's determined by the spectrum. So the point was that this was motivated in some sense by a random walk problem, and the view is that the by looking at ordinary random walks on the k-symmetric power, you're investigating a more complicated class of walks in the original graph, and the walks are closely related to the spectrum, again, what you say. Now, we all made some observations, some computations, and discovered that the spectrum of x, the symmetric square, is much better at distinguishing spectrum of graphs than the spectrum of x by itself, but it still failed on strongly related graphs. Now, where do you get these strongly related graphs from? Well, Ted Spence in Scotland has a web page with a bunch of strongly related graphs on there, and whatever a physicist needs a strongly related graph, they look there and they take them. And they forget that he only gives the graphs not the complements, but so it's not a complete list, but there's a list of strongly related graphs, and that list goes up to 36, which is more or less as far as we can get at this point. And so, in particular, if I gave you two Latin squares of order 4 before, that gives you two graphs on 16 vertices, they're both strongly regular, his results fail on that. Now, he was telling all this to me. Now, think about it. You've got a graph on 36 vertices. The symmetric square has got 36 to choose two vertices, which is close enough to 500 vertices. And so how do you get the spectrum? Well, he started in that class and asked for the spectrum, which shows a touching faith from my point of view, but something to do. And you don't have to do any solving. You've got a postdoc to do these things. So, okay, you can compute the spectrum of the symmetric square. If you trust MATLAB, you can come to some conclusions. But so his problem was, well, you know, in certain sense, it's not entirely clear whether this is what's going on. You can't compute, for the graphs on 16 vertices, you probably can compute the spectrum and convince yourself you've got non-isomorphic symmetric squares with the same spectrum. The graphs on 35, you can't be sure whether it's machine error or something what you want, or that you can't distinguish. And so we got to thinking about this, and I did some work now. What I managed to show eventually was the spectrum of the symmetric square of x is determined by the spectrum of x and this mess here. Now, the key thing about this mess is, okay, this is just the adjacency matrix. This circle denotes what's usually called the bad student's product matrices. You just take two matrices and multiply them entry by entry. So the important thing here is they have two matrices the same shape, and so that's the shared product, called the shared product. Now, so we got this mess now. It looks pretty bad. It looks like an infinite series of matrix coefficients, and it is. But I only want the determinant of it, the first thing. The other thing is, if I sum in a strongly regular graph, like a Latin square graph, well, these powers of A just tend to be linear combinations of I, J, and A. Now, the shared product of J with A is A. The shared product of I with A is going to be 0. So all these powers are going to go away. And what you're going to have there is a linear combination of I, A, and J with rational functions and T as the coefficients. So there's only three terms. Okay, so in other words, you've got a matrix with rational functions and T as entries, and you want the determinant of that. And you can show that determinant that's going to be, if the graph is strongly regular, that determinant is determined by the parameters of the strongly regular graph, K, A, and C. So that means if the graph is strongly regular, then this is determined by the spectrum of X, and everything else is determined by the spectrum of X, and so therefore the symmetric square is not going to work, which is the bad news. This is on the, this is just so that I make sure I miss my co-authors. Vector and Y are strongly about the same parameters, the symmetric square is a co-spectral, and the complement is a co-spectral, and various other things happen. But in all cases tested, the spectrum of the symmetric cube determines X. Now, 36 choose 2 is around 500, I only want to think what 36 choose 3 is. But there are some numerical analysts in France who had a program looking for test cases, a big matrices, and they ran through all the strongly related graphs on 35 and 36 vertices, and just as an aside here, they said there were 32,548 strongly related graphs on 36 parameters with the same parameters as the 6 by 6 Latin squares. Okay. And they found that in all these cases, the correct polynomial that they tested, the correct polynomial in terms of the graph. Looks complex. Now, so the point is, the problem is, I don't know, I had, the result I gave you, this thing was complicated enough. I mean, it was a messy looking formula and the derivation's not pleasant. I have not, now I can do something analogous in the subject too, but there's no way I can give you the delight that I gave you to simplify it. I get something messy and I'm stuck. So I know nothing about the spectrum of symmetric tubes, really. Okay? The other comment, of course, even if I do manage to dispose of the cubes and show that doesn't work, you can turn around and say, what about the fourth power? And in fact, in terms of complexity, I mean, he can say, well, I'll take k to be log n, or square root of n. And if you can show that if that works, you've still got to speed up on the known algorithms to graph once more. And at the moment, I don't see how to get anywhere near the problem. The general feeling people are interested in this sort of graph isomorphism spectrum, only me and Brendan McKay, is this stuff shouldn't work. That was my first reaction, that was Brendan McKay's first reaction when I told you about it, but it's not clear. And so to finish up, I just want to point out that, well, in all these cases, these problems, like as I said, these physics come with these problems, I wasn't generating them in any sense, the various graphs I'm constructing, so the instance graphs I was constructing from the affine planes, the graphs I was constructing from the plus minus one vectors, and these strong red graphs are all instances of what I call an association scheme. Now, for the immediate purposes, an association scheme is a commutative algebra of symmetric matrices, which is closed on the Schur multiplication and contains the matrix J. Now, it turns out this is a very special class of algebras. There's a lot of combinatorial structure. The algebraic structure is pretty simple, but there's a lot of combinatorial structure. And these things have turned up in various places. Here I mentioned in group theory, geometry, and even in knot theory. And it's something of a surprise to them turning up in physics as well. That's the talk. Thanks for your attention.
Same as like a closed loop, or they're more complicated?
When I'm talking about the spectrum, they're closed.
So
they must start to finish at the same vertex.
Does this give you a good way of sort of counting all the loops of different lengths?
So if you wanted to count the number of closed walks in a graph of length n, then you can do it from the formula. There's the trace of the nth power, and you can compute that from the spectrum. There's a recurrence, which goes back to Newton, I think.
Would you be quicker than using that?
Well, it'd be quicker than computing the nth power by and trying to read it off. So it would be quicker to use the spectrum rather than just multiply the matrix stuff.
Yeah.
Other questions?
With that last idea with the k taking the k symmetric power of k is constant times n or something like that? Is that
constant times?
Does it actually determine or is that far from all k?
The thoughts cross my mind. I don't know.
The point is that if k is constant times n, then it takes just as long to compute the.
Well, yeah, it's not very useful. It's clear that it's not very useful in that sense.
Yeah.
But my real point was simply that k can be comparably large. I mean, even k equals 10 is essentially infinite for this purpose.
Other questions? I had a question about the chromatic number of the graph omega to the n.
Yeah.
So you know that it's at least, it's greater than to the n.
Yeah.
Do you have a bound on it?
Well, I don't, but there is something, as far as Frank Macroodle, it grows exponentially with n.
And
with n. It grows exponentially with n.
The base is greater than 2 or something.
Yeah.
If there are no more questions, let's start this again for